Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Haygop Kantarjian for his take on what's new and exciting in MDS, AML, APL, and more. And to begin, he commented on myelodysplastic syndromes.
In MDS, I think the two drugs which are FDA approved and are benefiting patients are azacitidine and decitabine. Both of them are FDA approved, but only azacitidine has shown a survival advantage in a European randomized study. The decitabine has not shown a survival advantage in a similar kind of study, which was decitabine versus best supportive care in myelodysplastic syndrome. Once patients fail the hypomethylating agent therapy, their median survival is very short, in the order of 4 to 5 months. So we have to develop treatments in that context, and this is where we're looking at several agents, including clofarabine, and we have reported a study of two schedules of IV clofarabine, but we also have a study with the oral clofarabine. And on average, we're showing response rates of 30 to 40% in patients who have failed azacitidine or decitabine. Now, the drug at the schedules we're using is still myelosuppressive, so we're trying to improve on the myelosuppressive toxicity of the regimens. Now, there are other things in myelodysplastic syndrome which are under development, including multikinase inhibitors, P38 inhibitors, and some of the other drugs, but they are all very early in the development. So the one significant lead in terms of MDS therapy is probably the clofarabine. There has been a whole area of research of hypomethylating agents and histone deacetylase inhibitors, but none of these studies has yet shown a definite benefit of the combination over the hypomethylating agents alone.
What's been seen other than myelosuppression with clofarabine in terms of tolerance?
Essentially, it's myelosuppression, but occasionally we see renal dysfunction, particularly in patients who are treated on outpatient therapy that have borderline kidney functions and who experience nausea or vomiting or get dehydrated.
Going back to azacitidine, one of the most common questions we get from oncologists in practice relates to the schedule. Obviously, it was developed with 7 days, which seems like not too many people use, and also how long to use it. How do you approach those questions?
So the first issue is, can we use 5 days instead of 7 days? And we have to remember that the survival advantage is with the 7 days. The 5-day schedule compared to the 7 days, the report by Lyons et al. In JCO, related to the incidence of hematologic improvements and responses, but it did not address the issue of survival. So I think while it's all right to use the 7 days with a break over the weekend, I think we probably need to be cautious when we use the 5-day schedule over the 7 days. So if we're bothered with the 7-day schedule because it overlaps over a weekend, I'd rather do a Monday through Friday and then make up the other 2 days on the next Monday and Tuesday rather than truncate the schedule to 5 days. Because as I said, we don't have evidence for the equivalence of the survival outcome. And the other question relates to the duration of therapy. And the more we use these drugs, the more we find that, in fact, when we stop after 12 or 24 cycles and the patients relapse, we can retreat them and produce responses in about half of the patients. So the relapses are not because of inherent resistance to the drug. It's simply because we stopped the treatment. So I think it would be soon time to look at randomized trials of 12 or 24 courses of hypomethylating agent therapies versus longer schedules to see whether there's going to be an impact on the survival or on progression-free survival. My patients, I usually offer 2 years of therapy, and then I give them the option of either stopping and watching or continuing, but with a lower dose schedule of the hypomethylating agents or a more infrequent schedule like every 5 to 6 weeks instead of every 4 weeks.
So if they're tolerating it, you'll try to get to 2 years with the Q4-week schedule?
That's correct. Every 4 to 5 weeks would be a reasonable schedule.
What about the issue of lenalidomide in MDS? You've published and studied that a lot. Anything new in that regard?
So lenalidomide in MDS is an established treatment, mostly in patients with low-risk MDS deletion 5q. There was the concern at least in Europe, that there was an association of lenalidomide therapy with transformation to acute myeloid leukemia. And I think that was put to rest by a study reported by Dr. Fenot looking at patients with low-risk MDS deletion 5q transfusion dependents who were randomized to either no therapy or placebo versus two schedules of lenalidomide, 5 and 10 milligrams a day. And that study has assured everybody that the incidence of transformation to acute myeloid leukemia was similar and that the 10 milligrams of lenalidomide was producing similar results as what was reported in the United States, meaning a transfusion independence rate of about 60 to 70%, a complete cytogenetic response rate of about 40%. So I think hopefully lenalidomide will continue to be a useful agent in subsets of MDS. The more pertinent question is, can we expand lenalidomide in higher dose schedules in either high-risk MDS or acute myeloid leukemia? And there have been some interesting studies with lenalidomide at dosages of 25 to 50 milligrams a day, alone or in combinations with azacitidine. So I think lenalidomide is a useful drug, not only in deletion 5q, but hopefully following investigational trials, it could be more established for the treatment of higher risk MDS in combinations with azacitidine and perhaps for subsets of AML, particularly the ones that have 5q abnormalities.
What are the clinical situations, if any, where you think it might be reasonable to use lenalidomide in non-5q deletion situations?
I think if you have a patient who is low risk, who's transfusion dependent, and where growth factor therapies or immune therapies have not worked well, but where the blasts are still low, I think it would be reasonable to add lenalidomide to a growth factor like erythropoietin to see if we can improve on the transfusion dependence, because in such situations, it becomes very frustrating that we have nothing else to offer, and yet the patient continues to require red cell transfusions on a frequent basis.
I'm curious what the most common questions are that you receive from oncologists in practice about MDS.
I think the frustrating issues are twofold. One, patients who are still with low-risk MDS, meaning the blasts are still low at 5% or less, but they have cytopenias, and where the physician may not want to embark on hypomethylating agent therapies. And here what we have developed are lower intensity schedules of azacitidine or decitabine. So decitabine for 3 days or azacitidine for 4 to 5 days. And what we see is that these schedules are not associated with significant myelosuppression and they could improve on the multilineage cytopenias. In this context, there's a very preliminary pilot trial of alemtuzumab, which is a CD52 monoclonal antibody. And that study has shown that in patients with low-risk MDS multilineage cytopenias, it has shown an improvement in the cytopenias in over 3/4 of the patients, which is very impressive. The other question that we hear often are patients who have higher risk MDS and who have failed hypomethylating agent therapy, because there we don't have any standard of care. Many patients could be given intensive chemotherapy followed by an allogeneic transplant, but the worry there is that most of the patients are too old for such strategies. So we need to discover new agents that could work in that setting, and this is where some of the nucleoside analogs like clofarabine or perhaps sepasitabine, which is a cytosine analog, could be more helpful.
You mentioned alemtuzumab, which kind of has a reputation of being a very difficult agent to use. How is it tolerated in patients with MDS?
The schedule in MDS is different. So, for example, in the setting of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, we use 10 and then 30 milligrams 3 times a week for at least 12 weeks. In the setting of the low-risk MDS with multilineage cytopenia, the schedule is a flat dose of 10 milligrams intravenously daily for 10 days. Now, I have to caution that this is very preliminary and this is an NIH study where there was a high patient selection based on criteria for potential success of immune therapy. So this is not ready for use in the community setting. I think in that setting, probably the use of antithymocyte globulins, cyclosporin, and steroids as an immune therapy might be more appropriate. But I wanted to mention the alemtuzumab as an agent that could surprise us once we have more experience with it.
How about AML? Anything new and exciting we should know about?
So in AML, I usually divide them into the younger patients where what we are trying to do is add something to the standard of care, which is idarubicin and RAC. And then the older patients in whom we know based on different models that if we use intensive chemotherapy, the 8-week mortality is going to be over 30%. So let's take the younger patients. Here there are several positive leads, including the use of FLT3 inhibitors. And this is the context where I want to mention a drug called AC220, which is a very potent FLT3 inhibitor. We just finished the phase 1-2 studies, and we see in patients who are multiply refractory to chemotherapy, if they have a FLT3 ITD abnormality, we have a response rate of about 50%. So I think this drug is going to be developed for that particular molecular indication, but we're going to add it to the intensive chemotherapy in the younger patients. Also, we're trying other FLT3 inhibitors like sorafenib, which has been approved for the treatment of some of the solid tumors. And we're also trying to develop epigenetic therapy with HDAC inhibitors added to the intensive chemotherapy. The final lead are the use of additional chemotherapeutic agents like clofarabine. There was also a report with lomustine, which was a study in France that compared two different populations receiving idarubicin RAC chemotherapy plus or minus lomustine, which was given at a single oral daily dose with the induction therapy, and they report an improvement in the outcome of these patients. This was just published in JCO. So in the younger patients, what we're trying to do is either add old or new chemotherapy or add targeted therapy to the intensive chemotherapy.
What about the hypomethylating agents in AML? What do we know about it? And in what situations, if any, do you think it's reasonable to use them off study?
The hypomethylating agents have shown definite activity in acute myeloid leukemia. Mostly, we're using them in the setting of older patients with AML in whom we believe intensive chemotherapy is too toxic, and that's based on an expected 8-week mortality of 30% or more. This is where drugs like azacitidine or decitabine could play a role. So I think it is reasonable for patients with acute myeloid leukemia unfit for intensive chemotherapy to consider some of the low-intensity therapies like azacitidine. What we've done also is develop low-intensity therapy which uses either clofarabine, low-dose RAC, or alternates that regimen with decitabine. And we report some preliminary data on this combination, which is encouraging in the setting of the ASCO meeting.
Let's talk a little bit about CLL. Again, looking back at ASCO in the last 6 months or through ASH, what's come out that you think docs should know about?
In fact, chronic lymphocytic leukemia is a very dynamic field recently. And I'm going to mention several studies. The first one is the long-term follow-up of the chlorambucil versus fludarabine study. This is a study that was reported by Dr. Kantria Rai several years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. And even though it had shown significantly better complete and overall responses favoring fludarabine, there was no survival advantage, which led some of the CLL experts to doubt the value of fludarabine therapy. At the recent meetings, Dr. Kantria Rai reported an 8-year update of this study, which shows that, in fact, there is a survival advantage which is significant in favor of fludarabine. So that, I think, establishes one more time that fludarabine is an excellent frontline standard of care in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and further limits the role of chlorambucil in that setting. Another study which was reported is by the Germans, and that study was based on the series of pilot trials demonstrating initially the efficacy of fludarabine, then the fludarabine cyclophosphamide, and then the combination of the chemotherapy with immune therapy with rituximab. So this led to a series of randomized trials comparing fludarabine cyclophosphamide to fludarabine, and then later fludarabine cyclophosphamide rituximab or the FCR regimen to the fludarabine cyclophosphamide. So the latest update from the German trials does show that FCR improves the progression-free survival and the survival of patients compared to FC, and this led the FDA to declare the FCR as a frontline standard therapy for chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And this has been something that was in the making for many years. If you remember, the pilot studies from MD Anderson has led to the FCR being used across the board over the past 10 years in the setting of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Now, there are other interesting leads. One of them is bendamustine, which is an alkylating agent that received approval for the treatment of, I think, lymphoma and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So there are now combination studies of the bendamustine with rituximab that are showing in the frontline setting a high overall response rate of about 90% with a complete response rate in a third of the patients. So I think this is another combined regimen that's effective in CLL. The question is it as good as FCR, or can it rescue patients who have failed FCR therapy? So bendamustine is an exciting agent, but still in search of a role in the setting of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It's much more established in the setting of the indolent lymphomas, where the bendamustine rituximab compared to CHOP-R has shown an advantage for that. Now, in the setting of CLL, there are several additional exciting developments. The first one are with the new monoclonal antibodies. So, for example, there's a monoclonal antibody called ofatumumab, which is a humanized CD20 monoclonal antibody that has received an approval for the treatment of refractory CLL. And now we're trying to use it instead of rituximab in the setting of the FC regimens, what we call the FC or the OFC regimens, combining ofatumumab with fludarabine cyclophosphamide. There were also updates on lenalidomide in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So lenalidomide is not only active in MDS and myeloma and in some of the lymphomas, but in the setting of CLL, we have seen very encouraging activity of the drug, either alone or in combination with rituximab. And the last thing I want to mention are several new targeted approaches to chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I'm going to mention three or four of them. The first one is a drug called GA101, which is also a humanized monoclonal antibody against CD20, which is showing reasonable activity in that setting. So a drug similar perhaps to ofatumumab in that setting. There's also a BCL inhibitor called ABT-263, and there is preliminary data with that drug in the setting of chronic lymphocytic leukemia showing reductions in the lymphocytes as well as in the disease burden in a significant proportion of patients with refractory disease. The third drug that's worth mentioning is a PI3 kinase inhibitor called CAL101. And again, this is a drug that targets the signaling pathways of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which has shown activity in that setting. And the final drug, which is again targeted therapy, which I'm excited about, is a small molecule BTK inhibitor. So it targets the Bruton kinase pathway. And this was a phase 1 study which showed response rates in about 50% of the patients, but particularly in the setting of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, the activity was so powerful that the company has moved very quickly into phase 2 studies. So I think in the setting of CLL, in addition to the classical chemotherapy, fludarabine and bendamustine, there are monoclonal antibodies mostly targeting CD20, which are more potent potentially than rituximab, as well as new inhibitors, small molecule inhibitors, and inhibitors of selective pathways in CLL that are showing very promising results.
I want to pick up on a few of the things you mentioned. First, you mentioned ofatumumab. What do we know right now about efficacy compared to rituximab? There were the theoretical reasons to think maybe it was going to be more effective. What do we know at this point?
In the preclinical studies, there's definitely a lot of rationale for that drug to be more potent. It acts on different epitopes of the CD20, and the modulation of the activity is different. In the clinical setting, there's no doubt that among patients who have failed rituximab, the response rate with ofatumumab is about 40 to 50%. And that's what gave a lot of excitement about that drug potentially replacing rituximab in the setting of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Now, ofatumumab in the salvage setting was developed at a dose of 2 grams, which people said could account for much of the efficacy. The subsequent studies looking at combinations have looked at 500 and the gram of ofatumumab, and the response rates there in combination with chemotherapy have not been astounding. So while I do think that ofatumumab could be superior to rituximab, we still have to conduct the proper studies, for example, of FCR versus FC plus ofatumumab, to establish whether there's equivalence or superiority of ofatumumab over rituximab.
Any reason to think there might be more of a differential between those two in CLL than, for example, follicular lymphoma?
I think it could be, but then it's just conjecture. I have no definite reason to believe that there could be a differential effect.
What do you think is a reasonable approach to using ofatumumab right now in CLL outside or protocol setting?
I think outside the protocol setting, we have to restrict its use to salvage therapy and perhaps not as a single agent, but in combinations. So I would generally favor using it in the context of investigational trials. But if somebody's pressured to use ofatumumab, I think they could use it within the indication. That is, patients who have failed fludarabine and or alemtuzumab, that's not that important. But patients who have failed fludarabine and rituximab, for sure, there could be some salvage rate that's pertinent. In that setting, one could look at ofatumumab in combination with something else, such as bendamustine or some other combinations.
And speaking of bendamustine, what about the patient with CLL, octogenarian comorbidities, FCR versus FR versus BR?
I think that's a very important question, because although the FCR data have shown significant differences favoring FCR for mostly progression-free survival, but also for survival, most of these studies have restricted the entries to the younger patients under the age of 70 or 75 or 80. Once you get over the age of 70, there's at least one German study which in fact compared fludarabine to chlorambucil and did not show an advantage of fludarabine. So this is where bendamustine could be a gentler drug that could have potential equal efficacy to an FCR regimen. But I think we should conduct those studies, take patients who are older than 70, and do some studies looking at FCR versus bendamustine rituximab. But in general, if I have a patient who's older than the age which accrued in the studies of the FCR, and if I want to go with bendamustine rituximab, I think that's a reasonable approach. Having said this, bendamustine does have myelosuppression that we have to worry about.
What about FR as opposed to FCR?
FR is a regimen that has been mostly publicized by the CLGB, and they did show in the long-term follow-up studies that FR is better than FCR. Now, the cyclophosphamide combinations are established to be superior. So there are studies from Europe that show that FC is better than fludarabine. So I generally tend to favor the inclusion of an alkylator in the combination, and therefore I would favor an FCR over an FR regimen. On the other hand, we do not have straight head-to-head comparisons of FR versus FCR. And so that could be a reasonable future questions in research trials.
What's your clinical experience in terms of, or your gestalt in terms of side effects and toxicity, FR versus FCR?
I think there's probably more myelosuppressive toxicities with FCR.
You mentioned the work on lenalidomide in CLL, and your group's done a lot of interesting work that you've been presenting over the last year. Can you talk about specifically what you've seen?
I think lenalidomide, either alone or in combination, has activity in CLL. At the low-dose schedule, it could capture a lot of responses, less so in the complete remissions, but more in the general overall response rate. Those responses are slow to occur, so one has to continue the therapy with these drugs. And I think it's the lenalidomide or lenalidomide rituximab could be an interesting combination, particularly in the older patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We mentioned the toxicity of FCR. We mentioned the worries with the bendamustine rituximab in terms of myelosuppression. I think lenalidomide is still myelosuppressive, but of these regimens, you can probably control best the toxicity of a lenalidomide rituximab in terms of starting with the low dose of lenalidomide, say 5 milligrams a day, and dose escalating gradually. But there's no doubt that this is an active regimen, and we have a publication at ASCO in elderly CLL with lenalidomide as frontline therapy starting at a dose of 10 milligrams a day. And we've treated about 60 patients who are all over the age of 65. The CR rate was low, 10%, but the overall response rate was 60%. And the survival at 2 years was estimated to be 90%, which appears to be as good, if not better, than our FCR regimen. So lenalidomide is an active agent, and perhaps either alone or in combination could carve out a possible role in the setting of elderly CLL.
Anything new in terms of tumor flare or tumor lysis syndrome with CLL and lenalidomide?
Right. So tumor flare is something we see, and people worry about it because they think that that could possibly indicate a false increase in the tumor burden. Now that it is recognized, we usually just tried it out and either give steroids, or when you use it in combination, say with rituximab, you do not see much of the tumor flare as we used to see it with single agent lenalidomide.
Anything new in terms of one of my favorite topics to discuss, which is APL?
Yes, so acute promyelocytic leukemia is a very interesting disease because I think the United States is lagging behind other countries in terms of the development. So because it's a highly curable disease, in the United States, the intergroup studies have been very cautious at taking small steps in the randomized trials. So now they are still comparing whether we need anthracyclines and high-dose RAC and maintenance therapy. In other countries like Iran, because arsenic trioxide is inexpensive, it's about $10 a day, they've gone with single-agent trials with arsenic trioxide. And in fact, at this ESCO meeting, there was an update from the Iranian group. The first author is Gavam Zadeh. And what they have now is 190 patients treated over the last 10 years. And what they show is with a single agent arsenic trioxide given during induction and then for 4 courses during maintenance. So the induction is 30 days. The maintenance is about 20 to 30 days times 4. So the total is about 120 days of arsenic trioxide. What they find is a 5-year event-free survival of 70%. So that tells us how powerful the single agent is, and perhaps it's the most potent APL agent. So what we've done is combine it with ATRA in the setting of APL at our institution, and we find that this non-chemotherapy combination is superior to our experience with ATRA and chemotherapy. Now, there is an intergroup study that looked in a randomized fashion at arsenic trioxide over a short period of 2 months in the setting of acute promyelocytic leukemia, and it did show a survival benefit for arsenic trioxide. This is a study that's going to be published, I think, in Blood. But still, the use of arsenic trioxide in the frontline therapy of APL is not common in the United States, and this is an instance where we need to get more education and maybe to get bolder in our investigational trials to move to non-chemotherapy regimens in APL.
What about in terms of clinical practice? What do you see in terms of how people manage this disease and diagnose it for that matter, and any sort of room for improvement, shall we say?
A lot of room for improvement. What we see is we lose a lot of patients before they get to a treatment management. So one of the issues is a lot of patients with APL present with cytopenia. And there is this trigger notion in the community practice when we see a patient with cytopenia to give them G-CSF, which on average doesn't do much harm or good. But in the setting of APL, this is the one disease that becomes highly proliferative with the growth factors. So we see a lot of patients with APL who present with cytopenias, they receive one dose of G-CSF and they come with a white cell count that goes up from less than 1,000 to over 20,000, and they present with florid DIC and massive bleeding and die. So if we can have some regulation whereby patients with cytopenias should not be given G-CSF unless you have a bone marrow and exclude APL, that would be useful. The second thing is the diagnosis. A lot of oncologists, because the disease is rare, wait for a definite diagnosis of APL, which is based usually on cytogenetics. I have tended to, any time you have a patient with acute myeloid leukemia with the suspicion of APL, to start ATRA therapy before the diagnosis is made, because there's almost no harm done and there could be a lot of benefit if we can control the DIC process early on. There is also a test that we published on in Cancer called the POD test, which gives you a diagnosis of APL within half to 1 hour of the patient's presentation. So we're trying to publicize that test so that a patient with leukemia could get that POD test and get an inclusion or an exclusion of an APL diagnosis within 1 hour of hitting an institution. So the three implementations that could help salvage a lot of mortality are not using any growth factors when there's a suspicion of APL based on cytopenia, two, trying to make a quick diagnosis based on this new POD test, and three, giving the patients ATRA therapy until you rule in or out the diagnosis of APL. Because even though we see a lot of studies that produce or report on cure rates of 80%, I think there's at least 10 to 15% of the patients who are lost before getting onto the studies. And this has been exemplified from a study in Czechoslovakia. This was an abstract at EHA where they showed in the setting of the country's evaluation that even after the implementation of ATRA, the cure rate of APL in that country was still in the range of 50%.
Interesting. What about clinical management once the diagnosis has been made? Which, again, your off-protocol algorithm?
The off-protocol algorithm is usually with what's called the AIDA, meaning ATRA induction chemotherapy with idarubicin, and there are different schedules of idarubicin. And then once the patients get into the consolidation, different people use different regimens. The one I favor is the AIDA regimen, and this is a regimen that was developed initially in Italy and then confirmed in Spain. And there's an MRC trial that compares more standard APL regimens to the AIDA, showing that the AIDA is more effective and less toxic. So the reality is, I think that of all the drugs in APL, arsenic trioxide is the most potent, but the next two very potent drugs are ATRA and idarubicin. A third drug, which is also very potent and targeted and not toxic, is the gemtuzumab ozogamicin, but unfortunately the FDA has mandated the withdrawal of the drug following the MRC trial that did not show a survival advantage on average and which showed perhaps a red herring of a higher mortality with the induction that contained the gemtuzumab ozogamicin. In that MRC trial, the induction mortality was less than 1% with chemotherapy, which we almost never see, and about 5% with the chemotherapy plus the gemtuzumab ozogamicin. So it's unfortunate that there is a decision to withdraw the drug based on average results, because now we're in an era of personalized therapy or individualized therapy. And I think even though gemtuzumab, which is a CD33 monoclonal antibody, has not shown on average to be beneficial in AML, I think it is beneficial in some subsets of APL, in subsets of the core binding factor leukemias, and perhaps in patients with the diploid karyotypes.
Anything new in terms of the pathogenesis and epidemiology of the disease? We've talked before about the Hispanic overweight woman. Anything new about that?
No, that continues to be an interesting epidemiologic trend. We find APL, and for that matter, acute lymphocytic leukemia, to be more common among Hispanics. For example, if you take the ratio of AML to ALL, acute myeloid leukemia to acute lymphocytic leukemia in the United States, the ratio is about 3-1. If you go to Mexico, it's the reverse. The ratio of AML to ALL is 1-2. So there's no doubt in my mind there are epidemiologic or economic factors or something in the environment that makes APL more common among Hispanics and that makes ALL compared to AML more common among Hispanics and people who come to the United States from Mexico.
So final question, you mentioned ALL. Again, anything new there?
There are many positive things. Very briefly, in the Burkitt leukemia, the combination of hyper-CVAD with rituximab is producing cure rates now in the range of 80%, when this disease used to be invariably fatal in the past. In Philadelphia, positive ALL, adding a tyrosine kinase inhibitor like imatinib or dasatinib to hyper-CVAD chemotherapy has now resulted in 3-year survival rates of over 50%. For the other patients with ALL, we're looking at new monoclonal antibodies, so again, ofatumumab, but also CD22 monoclonal antibodies bound to colchicine. One of them is called CMC544 that we're quite excited about. And then there is a monoclonal antibody called blinatumomab, which is a bispecific monoclonal antibody, so it binds to CD19 and to CD3 and therefore activates the T cells to kill residual disease. And the Germans are very excited about this drug in terms of its value in the setting of ALL with minimal residual disease.